Thank you very much, folks. Good morning. It's great to see you. And this is not an announcement, it's a warning. Jackie is in the building. Thank you. I thought I was already getting cross-eyed looking at that thing. It's great to see everybody. This is an unusually large group for Sunday. Yeah, and the Sunday is normally for just the hungry and the hardy. That make that go. Everybody else sort of falls out from a tree, just from whatever, exhaustion. So it is great to see you. I'm going to talk so fast this morning you'll think I'm from Ohio. we got a little bit of a little bit. We don't have a real tight schedule, but I got nothing major league. But I got a little bit of surgery in the morning, and I want to be in good fighting shape. Because when somebody comes at me with a knife, I want to be ready to fight back. And so we're going to try to get back at decent hour. An old man has to go to bed before dark. It is great to see everybody, and I've thoroughly enjoyed the weekend. It's just been great. Just really good. You know, particularly enjoyed the time between meetings where we just get a chance to visit. Told him on the way over here this morning that the amazing thing about this program is that I don't think there's anything in it. There's not a page in the book you couldn't spend a week on. And so the more you look at it, by God, there's just no end to where you can go. As I was just sort of getting fresh this morning about things that are important to me in those last three steps. And as I want to go through them, and just by way of introduction of that, it's kind of like I've hinted at a few times over the weekend. You know, it doesn't say transition time anywhere in there. But I know most of you are familiar with the book. And when you go through the promises, you know, those promises almost sound like pie in the sky optimism. But what it says is that if you've done the work thoroughly up to this point, which means going through amends, that you'll be amazed before you're halfway through with it. And then it lists 12 unbelievable things that will have started to happen. And it just really does sound like pie in the sky stuff, but it's very real. And what those promises do is sort of tell what the payoff is for the actions of those first steps. Now this is just, naturally, it's going to be just my interpretation of it. But I think the game changes when you get through with the promises. And it switches from doing the things that I need to do for my own wellness and healing and all of that, in the sense of working on things that are troubling to me, and switches in to focus on others. And I think that's a kind of an important juncture. I had an old buddy down in Raleigh years ago that he always said something that made an awful lot of sense to me. He said, AA is a selfish program. We all acknowledge that. It is a selfish program. Yeah, I had an old buddy that used to do a lot of good work in AA. And I've heard him say a lot of times that, and I know it was a rhetorical statement, but it was always troubling to me every time he said it. Because he would say to a group, if one of us has to drink again, I hope it's me instead of you. Well, now I tell you, that's a wonderful sentiment. But you ain't going to hear me say that. Now, if somebody got to go down in this crowd, I'm sorry. But I hope I'm the last dude standing, I'll tell you that. So it is a selfish program, bottom line. But what I have to understand, if I'm going to get full benefit of this deal, is that it's the weirdest selfishness in the world. It's about 10% gimme, and it's about 90% give. And if I don't learn that, I think I miss the whole deal. Because I have to learn that this is not a selfish thing in the sense of it's always about me. I have to learn that my greatest benefit comes from actively reaching out and helping others. That's what keeps me green and growing and vigorous and rewarded and all of that stuff. And you just one other little thing, I'm sure you've heard it, but it's a good reminder to me. about the two bodies of water over in the Middle East that they're shooting over right now. But they're there. The two bodies of water, the Dead Sea and the Sea of Galilee. They're in the same geographical area, same climate, same rainfall, same everything, except for one thing. The Dead Sea is properly named. It's dead. It supports absolutely no life whatsoever. No grass, no fish, no nothing. Sea of Galilee, not far away, is alive and vibrant and supports life and people fish there and all that. And what's the difference? The Dead Sea has no outlet. The Dead Sea is a dead end. And what comes is a stagnant, vile pool, rather than a vibrant, living thing. And I think the same thing happens to us. If we stop, if we can't get to the point where we are a channel and the energy flows through us to others, and then we get the feedback, we just miss it. If you think it's all about me, we got Dead Sea is a pretty good analogy. And so I like to keep that in mind when I start talking about these steps. I don't think it means I become a missionary, but just a realist that I do this when I welcome a newcomer into AA. I always tell them that I need them more than they need me. I know they never believe that. I know that. They say, what are you kidding, man? I tell you, the police don't even want me. But I say, I need you more than you need me. They never believe it. My prayer is that I believe it. I believe it. If I ever get to the point I'm some Daddy Warbucks helping people and Mahatma Gandhi of the humanity, and I'm in trouble. And so I won't need to know that I need that, because it's what keeps me hooked in and moving. So with that introduction, let me get into those steps a little bit. I'm not going to beat you over the head with the book too much. I'd rather beat you over the head with what I'm thinking about. You know, you go get beat over the head about something. There's one place in here that's on, this is not on exactly on 10, but it's the same sentiment in the thing about the amends deal. There's a little deal on 77. I know everybody here has seen it. At the moment, we are trying to put our lives in order. And that's during that amends process. Sure we are. But this is not an end in itself. Our real purpose is to fit ourselves to be of maximum service to God and the people about us. And as I think that's a great sentiment. It's on 77. And it sort of sets the stage for those last three steps. And in that transition, let me spend just a little bit of time in the book to tell you some things I think sort of key that thought to me. That 10, the way it's written, it sounds as if it were all about inventory. But there's a real kind of a tone about that inventory that I think is important. That here's what it said. We suggest we continue to take personal inventory and continue to set right any new mistakes as we go along. We vigorously commence this way of living as we cleaned up the past. So we've understood that. You know, but the real sentiment of this thing is that we've been restored. We've got our critical stuff going. The bleeding has stopped. We've started to feel some energies and some juices and some worth. And what we're restored to, though, is life. We're not restored to some supernatural state where we transcend life and rise above the problem. We get restored to life. And it's life like every other human. Sometimes it's great. You know, just like this. You know, I get pumped up at something like this. Now, I'll probably be talking old man to death while he's driving me home. Because I get pumped up. And life is great. You know, I think everybody on 77 is going to get out of the way and let us get on down there. Because they'll get me back to reality pretty quick about that. But life sometimes is great. You know, that I just feel so good. I feel left-handed. It is wonderful. And those are peaks. But there are other times when it's just as sharply the other way. Sometimes it pure sucks. I mean, it just is bad news, and it gets grim and dark. And say, oh my God, what's the point? Yeah. But most of the time, life just goes on. And it's just sort of, It's not black or white. It's just sort of gray. It just sort of goes on. It's life. We go to work. If we want to eat, we go to work. You know, we do the stuff of life. And so the tone of the step is that in when we're living life, there are going to be times when we goof. That's just human. I mean, every human being is going to err. But the inventory in 10, the way I look at it, it's a quick fix. You know, we don't need to go into Freudian analysis just because we did something stupid, you know. But all you do is just say, hey, I goofed, man. I'm sorry about that. Let's straighten it out. And I think that's exactly, to me, that's the tone and the tempo of what this 10th step's about. It's not about continuing study of me and analyze, like the buddy I mentioned who analyzes, 25 years sober, analyzes every movement of every day. Come on. Come on. You know, this one is about moving on, getting on with the business, living, straighten it up so that it gets taken care of and doesn't do like that resentment, turn inward and get infected. So take care of it and deal, get it out of the way. But then there's one other statement, and I think I'll close the book maybe. That if we've harmed anyone, when these crop up, you know, when these old behaviors crop up, you know, we're rude, crude, or, you know, push somebody around, whatever. When those things happen, we ask God to remove that thing that's sticking its ugly head up again. Then, action. We discuss it with someone immediately and make amends quickly. Not long-term gestalt therapy. Just make amends. Take some action. If we've harmed anyone. Now here's the key to me. Then we resolutely turn our thoughts to someone we can help. Not linger in the past and not agonize over the nuances of stuff. We take care of it and move on. We immediately turn our attention to someone we've helped. And to me, that's that whole sentiment about the inventory and all that it means. Let me push a little bit on the other side of that. In taking care of that, but in the important message in the first paragraph, I am going to have to go back to the book because I don't want to state this wrong. I mean, God knows the world hinges on whether I say this just right or not. I'm sure somebody will correct me very quickly if I don't get it right. But I want to get it out of the book. Because I think there's key language in it for this whole thing that's triggered in this step. It's talking about taking that inventory, and this is the thing after this, we've commenced this way of living. Now we have entered the world of the Spirit. Yeah. We've got a spiritual life. We've got a higher power. We've got a way of life that's working. We've entered the world of the Spirit. We're no longer running on just self-control and self-will and all this kind of business. We got a power, and we got a spiritual life that we can live. So we got a different way of living. Our next function is to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Now you'd have your own definition. I'll tell you mine. I don't think that means deep insight about myself. I don't think that means additional deep-seated thinking about me. I think it has to do with how do I function well in my service life with the folks I would be of maximum service to. Very important for me to grow in understanding and effectiveness. Take that newcomer that I always try to greet with the salutation I just cited. When I look at that revolving door of how many people come into AA and go out, I don't think it's enough for me to just bemoan that. I don't think it's enough for me to just say, well, they just don't do it like that anymore. They're just different kind of drunks or something. I don't believe any of that. Yeah, I believe they're the same folks we are, folks with wrecked lives. And so when I see that tragic kind of parade of people walking through here and leaving as if they were untouched, that troubles me. And so I think what this message is to grow in understanding. What is it? What is it that makes it difficult for this person to catch what we've got? And I think it's my responsibility to exhaust all of my capability to see that I work with people adequately to give them a good strong hold in this thing and not just demonize the newcomer. But the point for me, I want to understand that. What is it that causes somebody to come in here and not be able to comprehend? We see it all the time. And I want to understand that. You know, if there's just a whole bunch of stuff related to that to talk about a little bit. But very important to kind of understand, if I'm going to be effective, I've got to understand the problem. And effectiveness is a word that doesn't get a lot of utility in our program. Ain't nobody here but us, so I'll say it. We're probably one of the most ritualistic groups of people I've ever seen. I mean, we are flat ritual people. And there's an old joke going around that's sad but true, that if we do something one time, it becomes a sacred tradition. And it doesn't make any difference whether it works or not. You know, that we read stuff. And I swear, if you watch a crowd when the reading's going on, you can read it in Farsi. Nobody knows the difference. You know, just words flying by. You know, we do it anyway. We do it because we do it. Why do y'all do it this way? Well, it was like that when I got here. We've always done it that way. Yeah, those are just things. They ought to be slogans on the wall because that's part of our language. And so it doesn't matter whether it works. We just do it. And effectiveness, if I really want to be of maximum service, if I really want to be helpful to other alcoholics, effectiveness is an awfully important measure. It's what I'm doing working. I'll give you an example. I think I've used this enough with you guys last year, Jack. Jack has not had a drink since we did that workshop. I don't believe. Best I can tell. I went up to a town up in the Northeast, real, real sophisticated intellectual community. And they really are. Well, it's home of Princeton University. I mean, God knows, that's the elitist, if you ever saw it. And the guy told me to come and speak at the 11th anniversary of a group that was developed for the sole purpose of working with people who had been mandated into AA because they were troubled that folks just didn't seem to connect well with it. They just didn't seem to do well. They didn't seem to... So they started this group so that they could deliberately give the kind of welcome and introduction that might be useful. So I'm talking to the two guys that were the original members of that group. And I asked them what to me is kind of a normal question. I said, well, how's it working? And both of them said, oh, fine, fine, fine. Yeah. And one of them said, now, what do you mean by that? A good question. I said, what I mean by that is, are people getting into recovery who get introduced in this group? I mean, that's a fairly logical question, isn't it? They looked at each other. One guy said, you know anybody? He said, no, I don't either. Now, come on. I don't care what you're selling. If you don't sell something in 11 years, you better take a look at the product. You know, my God, man. But isn't that crazy? You know, we get caught up in it, and because it's a holy mission, we think our job done. You know, well, the mission ain't very successful if the patient dies. You know, surgeon was brilliant. Wait, I don't want to talk about that right now. I hope my surgeon's a klutz. And we, no, he'll do great. I know he will. Yeah, but you think about that. You know, you think how often we do that, and it's a vital question if we really want to be of service. I mean, if we just want to play roles and you know, and act like we're doing something, fight. If we just want to go ahead and take care of our duties and do our rituals, good. But if we genuinely want to give somebody a fighting chance to make it in recovery, I think it's very important for me to, not just us or the General Service Conference or anything like that, it's important for me to try to understand to the best of my ability, what's it going to take here? What are we doing that's not working? Old folks and I, on the way up here, talked about the prison group we sponsor. And our concern is that at the surface level, it looks good. Looks good. The folks are doing things and stuff like that. But when you listen to the guys, deep down, you don't find that solid, committed connection that's vital. And if a guy walks out of there and he's not ready to fight the fight of his life, he's screwed. And so our challenge is, how can we ratchet that down to a deeper, more effective level? That's how we enjoyed the scenery on the way to Ohio. Let's talk about how to get folks out of penitentiary and get them to stay. So that's the kind of thing I'm talking about. And I think that's where 10th step kind of leads us into, is that the game changes, and now I need to look, if I want to be of maximum service, if all I want to do is be comfortable, then I don't need to pay attention to that. But if I want to be of maximum service, if I want to really feel the juices and the zest and the rewards of recovery, I will never get those by working on me. Will not happen. I'll get those when I get myself out of the way and become a maximum service and become a channel. You know, then I'll be getting somewhere. And so to me, that's what that transition is about. It's getting it to focus off of me directly and what I need, and getting into how I can be a good instrument doing God's work around wherever I can come in contact with people. So that's an important transition to me that starts to open it up. I mentioned that badge in Chicago yesterday sometime, that service is the secret. And I really believe it is. And I'll tell you one thing, that I was in the airport a while back in Raleigh a couple weeks ago. And I wanted a sandwich. I went in a place, and there was a nice girl that served me a sub. And I could tell she'd eaten a few of them, too. She was a healthy girl, if I put it that way. And she was wearing a badge that said, "Surge into Service." And I looked at that, and I said, "Boy, I like that badge." And she said, "Oh, thank you." I said, "No, I mean, I really like that badge." And she looked at me, she said, "Really?" I said, "Yeah." She said, "I'll give it to you." And so she gave me the badge. She had, I wore that sucker to the conference. Because that's exactly what it does. It serves into service. I didn't con the girl. I told her the truth. And she rewarded my telling her the truth. I'll buy her a sub someday. Well, that's just fun. You know, I mean, those are just good, fun things. But they pay off, you know, when you start doing stuff with people. So, in that whole business of getting into that frame of mind, I've got to look at that thing called effectiveness. I'll tell you one other thing about that, and I hope I can make this make some sense. If I really want to be of maximum service, I mean service to the max, I have got to be able to start thinking beyond my own shadow. Let me see if I can tell you what. Have y'all seen George this morning?
Yeah.
Is that beautiful?
Yeah, he's cheating.
He's what?
He's cheating.
Cheating?
Yeah.
What, getting cool?
Boxers under that.
Oh, my God. How do you know? Don't leave, old man. He's not going to take his skirt off. He's not going to leave. I told him if we could, I told him that outfit, if we get the old man to sing, he would sound like bagpipes, and he could do the Highland Fling or something. That's great. I tell you what, that is a uniform of honor in Scotland, believe me. Yeah, very much so. And once you get used, yeah, it is. Y'all shouldn't pull me off track. I forget where I was. talking about being a maximum servant. If I got to do that, I got to count myself one. Yeah, I'm just one guy. Yeah, I'm one member. Yeah, but I'm one. And if I'm going to be of service, then you know, there's a certain amount I can do that's right in front of me. I mean, and I've got enough to keep me busy forever doing that. But it's limited, eh? Yeah, if I look at you know, if what I do as an individual, you know, I can chair meetings, I can do workshops, I can do stuff like this. That's one dimension. But that's a finite kind of a thing. You know, that's a limited kind of thing. That would be as useful as I can got time to do it. And there's nothing wrong with it. But is that maximum service? I don't think so. You know, if I really want to be a maximum service, I've got to think beyond just me and my shadow and think bigger. I've got to think about my group. Now, you've probably gathered yesterday, I have a very strong bias toward groups. And it's not just because I like structure and organization. I like achieved results. That's what I like. I like primary purpose being met. That's what I like. And so if I want to be a maximum service, my group is an extension of who I am. I'm only as strong as the group that supports me. And when I greet that newcomer, it's nice for me to tell him I need him more than he needs me. And I can get him off in a corner and duke him around and all this kind of stuff. But if I don't have a group that delivers what I promise, I'm conning the guy. I'm conning him. And so if I want to be effective, I've got to recognize that it's not just how much I do with my own sphere of activity. If I want, I want to develop a group. And that group will do 40 times more than me. See what I'm talking about? If I want to be a maximum service, I've got to get it off of me and let that be a bigger thing. I've got to look at my district. You know, well, how is my district? You know, I belong to a good, strong group. But that doesn't mean anything. What kind of a neighbor are we to the next group? We don't operate in isolation. You know, we're just one group. So I need to be concerned about my neighbors, you know, if I really want to be effective. Because folks aren't going to come to just my group. And I want our fellowship as a whole to be healthy and well. And so I've got to be, if I want to be effective, if I want to be of maximum service, I've got to think bigger. And then carry it on to my area. And then to my fellowship. And just like the example I gave about the Kenya thing we were talking about. You know, that's in the sphere of maximum service. And I mean, you don't plan to do those things, but if you're tuned in and you're doing service, they just accrue to you. They're just going to happen. And so that to me is the spirit of this whole thing that happened in the 10th step. I tell you one other thing that I got about 2 weeks worth of notes. So I'm trying to pick out which ones to talk about. You never know what's going to happen. I just sort of dangle this out as something to think about. We bemoan a lot of things. And a lot of them we think are insoluble, that we just can't do anything about them. I know there's some guys here that are carrying some paper. Please be comfortable with what I'm going to say. But I've been troubled ever since we started doing this mandating of people to AA and, you know, trying to get, you know, certification that you did it. I've been troubled by that because I think it poses more barriers to recovery than it does bridges to recovery. And that's troubled me for a long time. That, you know, if you just so you think with me about this thing, if you contrast how we deal with that now, to, you know, the history. Remember how Ebby got into AA? Mm-hmm. He's court ordered. Well, no, he wasn't court ordered. He was court allowed. Yeah, a big difference. 180 degree difference. Yeah, some people, they weren't even AA people, but they were the seeds of AA. And these folks went to the court and said, give him to us. And the judge said, what have I got to lose? He's an idiot anyway. And so, you know, but you think about it, see, that's where this came from. And there was a whole ethic that grew out of that, where at one time in this country, a judge who allowed somebody to come to AA would get a standing ovation in OA, in AA, OA, in AA. Today, he would be apt to catch a brick. See, what happened, we've done a 180 on that. And now, instead of us petitioning the court and saying, give AA a try, instead of lockup, total reversal. Now, the court has the responsibility and is trying to mandate some kind of assimilation in AA. And when we do that, it just creates kind of awkward stuff. That I know that sometimes it's embarrassing. It's embarrassing to come in and have to ask somebody. And we've developed an attitude about that, that sometimes we're not all that helpful in doing it. And somebody asks to do it, say, yeah, okay, you know, just sort of a dismissing kind of a thing. And I'll give you an example of what that. And I want to do just a little bit of preliminary on this thing. So, and I'd like to challenge you to do something about it. Wife and I we had a weekend, and I said, it's something like I'm going to do some relaxation by traveling. But I had a weekend. I said, you want to go goof off somewhere? And she said, yeah, where? I said, let's go to Disney World. I'd like to get you some rat ears down there. So we did. We went to Orlando for a few days. And I did get her some rat ears. She looked good in them with nothing else on. And she looked great. Where's Bob? Edit, Bob. We went to a meeting. We found a meeting, and it went in. It was a ragtag little old meeting. But we went in. There was one, drove up to the place. It was real dark. And there was a guy sitting by the kitchen door. And I rolled the window down. And he said, yeah, this is it. So I said, okay, come on. Wife and I went in. It was open. Went in, and it was that guy and us. And then there was another one straggled in, and then another one. And then right before the meeting started, I'm sitting there, and I'm looking. I've seen a lot of stuff today. But a door opened other than the one we came in. And here came nine people marching in. I said, what is this, man? I looked like the parade. You know, no bagpipe when the parade was coming in. And they sat at the table. Well, now I kind of figured what it was. You know, I mean, we don't go to meetings like that. We go in a herd. So it started out, and it was a brittle meeting. You know, just cold. The old boy by the door read some stuff, and then he figured I could read. He asked me to read something, and then we started to talk, and he asked me to say something. And before that, he said, you might have noticed that this is not your average meeting. I said, yeah, it did strike me that way. And he said, these folks that just came in are on probation, and they report to the office, which is next door. And then they send them over here. And so I said, you know, I am really glad to be here. And in the middle of this, because I told him just what I told you, I said, I've been really concerned for a long time of whether that's helpful or harmful. You know, of just what that means to somebody who's caught in that system. Now, you talk about a meeting coming alive. So I said, what do you guys think? Well, holy mackerel, man. I mean, you talk about unleashing fury. I mean, man, it came out. But we wound up having a great meeting because we weren't talking a bunch of pious platitudes. We were talking where they lived right then. And so we got into some communication, and we had to run them off after the meeting. They wanted to hang out. Now, I don't know if that made them AA members, but what it said was just how difficult that is. And, you know, we had a a correctional facility. I keep pointing to old man because I got to get verification from him. If he nods or is awake, I know he's with it. And we had a little committee meeting, correctional facility committee in our group, and we finished our business, I brought it up. I said that, you know, that court paper thing worried me for a long time. And I said, why don't we see if we can do something about it? In fact, he said it. He said, oh, hell, Tom, you can't do anything about that. They do it all over the country. And I said, yeah, I know that, but let's don't fix the whole country. Let's just look right here and see if we can do anything. So, all right, we'll try. So we did. And we took that on as a CPC project. And so what we did, I don't want to spend the whole time on this because we got to leave. I got to go get under the knife. What we did, I never had really thought through why that bothered me so much. But it did bother me. And so one day I was flying somewhere, and we had set up a meeting with the head of the probation system in our area, in our immediate area. And I really wasn't prepared for the meeting because I hadn't really thought through what's the problem. And what do you do about it? I think when you go and dump a problem on somebody's desk, you got to have a solution right behind it. And so I started listing what bothered me about that, just like I listed those expectations yesterday. I mean, those agents of harm to emotional sobriety. And so I started listing about what's good about that and listed 10 things that might have value. All 10 had value to the official. None had clear value to the client, in my judgment. I put question marks beside 3 because they might, maybe, on a good day, maybe. Didn't really believe it, but I wanted to be generous, so named 3. And my God, I had to just quit on the negatives. That, you know, it's a horrible introduction to AA, I believe. It's like somebody comes in wearing a brand, you know. It's very difficult to get a genuine introduction to AA when you come into a different door. You come into a different portal. And so it's an awkward kind of a thing where you kind of feel like a second class member or not a member at all, just somebody that's just sort of there. And over the years, there's been an attitude that's developed about that. You know, somebody says sometime that if AA ever dies, it'll be killed from the inside. All we have to do is develop hardened attitudes so that we no longer see newcomers as the lifeblood, but we see them as an intruder. And when that starts to happen, the spirit of this program is dead. And so it's troubling. You got into some real sort of harsh kind of attitudes about it. You got groups. I won't name the town, but I went into a town a while back. Well, it was just a few blocks from where we'd held an international convention some years back. Just right up the street from it. And there was a big sign on it didn't say welcome to the weak and weary. Welcome to the land of beginning again. The big greeting was, we do not sign papers. And I thought, isn't that a hell of a note? That we're going to make that the beacon of hope. We don't sign paper. Well, it's a problem, is the point. That's a real problem. And so I just think we can do better. I wrote something down on that thing that I never really thought through. I normally, if somebody asked me to sign a paper, I know this is shucking and jiving a little bit, but I'll say, see her. She'll take care of that, you know. Now, I mean, that's just passing the buck, you know. But that's what I'd do. I'd just weasel out, you know. I'd say, she'll take care of that. Because it may not bother her as much as it did me. Yeah. And so so I'd shove it off. Never had really thought about why I felt like that. And I wrote down something that when I do that, it makes me something other than an alcoholic to another alcoholic. It automatically makes me an agent of the criminal justice system. It automatically makes me somebody who is an approver or a validator. That's not what I want to be. I want to be an alcoholic to an alcoholic, and that's all. Well, anyway, I sell that because I really would. If you're troubled with that kind of thing, do something about it. Do something about it. And so we wrote that stuff up, went to see the guy, and when we were going through the stuff, had it written up, and we'd had maybe half a dozen suggestions on things that could be done. And so we went through, and the guy, like any government official, he was defensive. You know, he wouldn't say anything, but you could tell his posture. He's behind his desk, back in the fight position. And so we started, and we got to that one I just was talking about. And he read that, and he said, "Well, I'll be damned. I never thought of that." I said, "Me either." "Me either. We even." Yeah. And from then on, it was a piece of cake. And so he said, "Well, God, let's fix it." And so he asked us to do some sessions with the probation staff to let them know what we were doing and get them bought into the idea. We set it up to have two probation officers at a time come in, as long as they're not packing. Don't come in packing. No, stay out if you're going to do that. It's got to work that so they could get acquainted and see what the program was. And then the real thing that was the key to me, they said, "Well, what do you do as an alternative?" And so what we suggested and they bought was do a 180 back to what we used to do. That tell the guy that he's got a problem and ask him what he's going to do about it. See what I mean? Put the responsibility on him. Instead of trying to get the court to be responsible, to mandate a new life. I mean, that's wishful thinking. Put it on the dude. It's his problem. And then that way he has the dignity of success or failure. And not just being chattel of a court, you know. And so you have to speak into this, Tony.
So instead of being friendly with our friends and having a working relationship like we used to, we've abdicated our responsibilities, now more one-sided than mandating people to our meetings. And as active AA members, we should be participating, doing our part like we used to. That way we've also gotten away from 12-step work in the traditional sense. We're no longer going out actively seeking alcoholics or gift wraps sent to us. And then we look at them, like you said, the differences. They're not sincere in wanting to be here like we've ever known anyone that was sincere in coming.
Yeah, well, right. We hide behind that sign saying we don't sign paper. Yeah, that I wish I could say it that well. That's exactly right, though. Yeah, wait a minute.
This whole conversation is a little bit, I see it from a totally different point of view. In 1974, I think it was, I went to a meeting under mandatory conditions. And my attitude was, I'd rather die before I set foot in this place again. But you know what? From that day on, I never forgot AA. That was my first contact with AA. I probably would not be sober today if I hadn't gone to that mandated meeting. In 1983... when I just kind of like threw my life into God's hands, I ended up at a meeting that night, and I would not have known it was there if it wasn't for being mandated to a meeting. So exposure's worth something.
Yeah. So Big Bang Theory does too. That's the thing I said yesterday. It's true that there's nothing that's not going to work for somebody, nor is there anything that'll work for everybody. What we have to do is look at the common welfare. Like, ironically, in our group, the first member that we had, first new member we had, he wasn't... he wasn't exactly mandated, but he came in from an agency, and he's been there ever since. But he's the only one. That's what I mean. You know, God knows how many hundreds have sent in. And sure, somebody's going to make it once in a while. Sometimes it plants a seed. But I think it drives away far more than it attracts. And that's the deal. And the deal is we can do better. We can do better. It's just what Tony was saying. When we lose the spirit of us taking initiative, of us reaching out, of us becoming passive-aggressive with the thing, we've lost something very valuable. So it's not just a matter of whether it might work once in a while. It's a matter of when we lose that quality in AA, we lose something vital to what we're about. And so I think there's a whole lot more to it. And the thing is, it's working. We've never had a piece of paper since. And people ask me if we still get people from probation. I cannot tell you how proud I am to be able to say, I don't know. It is none of my business. What brings somebody to Alcoholics Anonymous is not my business unless they want to tell me. It's kind of like I was saying yesterday, yeah, we don't examine motives or credentials or this kind of junk. Yeah, we stick out the hand and say, so it's just a sticky wicket.
Yeah, Mr. Jack.
Hi, Tom. I think that whole deal, because I came here over 20 years ago, and I was mandated to go to one meeting. And it was just enough, you know, to set the hook and make me want what was here, you know, to see those happy people in the meetings. And that particular area was a very strong fellowship area. And I think that problem addresses the problem that we see in AA as a whole today, and that's the lack of direct one-on-one sponsorship with the steps in our fellowship today. We really don't have, I think today, as strong a program inside of the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous as we did 20 years ago. So our ineffectiveness with the new fellow that comes in on mandated papers and what we do with him once we get him here is what's lacking.
Yeah, it is. That'd be a whole different workshop, but yeah, I really think something happened. We got institutionally focused about 25, 30 years ago when treatment emerged. We started getting people siphoned in, banned in. You know, we lost a lot of stuff in terms of our need to go get them because we were overwhelmed with the numbers coming in. So, but in the course of that, I think the bad news was that we did lose some of those vital kinds of things about our need for an alcoholic, and we've gotten more institutionally oriented, and so there is some big work to do in that. That's a whole different workshop. The big thing is, what I'd say is, you're going to find remarkable exceptions in anything. Look at the overall effectiveness. Look at that. And if you're satisfied that you got something good going, fine. You know, help it. But if you got questions like I did, investigate it. Take a look at it. See if it's something that needs attention. And so that's what we've got to look at it. Our job is to reach the alcoholic still suffering. Our job is to reach out, is to take those actions that are going to cause people to be able to find this thing. And that's just one example. I mean, you could do the same thing with treatment or just anything else that, Yeah, it does. You find, in fact, you find some of the same dynamics with people coming out of treatment. That we went through a period where we vastly overrated the treatment experience, and the word would get out that when people came out, it was equivalent to 1 year or 5 years recovery. That what we failed to recognize that treatment is not AA. Treatment removes the barriers to recovery. It's vital. It's important. Really, really helpful. But when you walk out of treatment, walk into AA, you're in day one of recovery. You're in day one of where you're actually practicing a program of recovery, and it's a critical time. And when we overrate that and say, well, this one doesn't need much help, we do a great disservice. So there are a lot of problems along those kinds of areas. And they're good ones to look at from the standpoint of effectiveness. And so look at that transition of, and my God, you could go all day with that kind of thing about how we try to package people and put them in. And so this whole business of how we get that individual chemistry where one alcoholic reaches out to another, my God, we'll never get any bigger than that. But we lose it when we get institutionally oriented, you know. So anyway, that gets a little bit heavy and heady, but it's you got to get to a mic. Is that on back there, Bob?
Yep.
Okay.
Hi, I'm Bill, alcoholic. I don't know if this is true or not. This is something I heard, but I heard that in the state of West Virginia, if you do 90 meetings, you don't have to pay your fines. I don't know if you've ever heard anything like that, or it's just something I heard. I'm not sure if it's true. I don't know if it's on your first DUI, second DUI, third DUI, but that was something I heard.
Well, I haven't heard it, but I wouldn't quarrel with it. I mean, I wouldn't challenge it. I guarantee you that I have long since quit being surprised at anything. West Virginia is wild and wonderful. That's the theme of the state. Well, we could deal with that in there, but I got more sermon here. I got to do some more sermon. I want to leave you to vex over that a little bit. You know, and if you're happy with it, right on. Yeah. But if you're troubled and you don't think that the drunk's getting a fair shake, take action. Take action. Effectiveness is what you're looking for. Yeah, that's it. Yeah, reaching out is exactly it. Just in the service realm. I wanted to talk a little bit about the part of these steps that kindled the way I function in terms of my personal stuff. Step 11 is about sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. And at first glance, it sounds like it's just about, going off staring at your navel and thinking great thoughts, and trying to get spiritually pure. And that's certainly part of it, improving my new relationship with a power that's vital in my life. Sure, that's part of it. It's a very important part of it. But I think, I know yesterday I referred to myself as a deeply spiritual guy, but it's spirituality in combat boots. I believe that spiritual life is an active life. It's a real vigorous life, a go-get-em life. And I think step 11, to me, is probably the greatest definitive action step that we have. What it's basically telling us to do is to use prayer and meditation to get equipped to go out and do life. And then when we get through with it at the end of the day, reflect on what we've done. Is it good work? Is it bad work? Is it something we need to fix? That's certainly one vital part of it. And I tell you, I don't know about you, but when I'm actively involved in doing service, when I start to reflect on my day, it is a rare day that I am not overwhelmed with gratitude. I mean, for not just for what's come to me, but just for the experience of life that day. Of the incredible kinds of opportunities to be of service, to do things that have some value, and tremendously rewarding little things. It's like that. That this kind of living is not just deeply satisfying personally; it's awfully rewarding. Just like I mentioned about that badge that little girl gave me. I mean, that's lightweight compared to a lot of the stuff that. What I find is that when I practice this kind of thing and I really seek out opportunities to be of service, I literally cannot put out more than I get back. I'll give you a couple examples of what I'm talking about. And I'm not a magical thinker. I just believe that good actions pay off. And, I mean, when 9/11 happened, I had to fly that next weekend. And went to the airport, and it was a zoo. I mean, it was just like you guys are going to see going back across the pond. You'll rise above it. Yeah, sure. But I went in up there, and I was kind of geared for it. I figured it was going to be bedlam, and I was right. And it was a mess. And so I went over to the place I had to go, and everybody had to go through the ticket counter. So I went over there, and some poor girl was back there by herself. And they had the alert on, and she had to handle everybody's bag. Everybody. She had to pick up wouldn't let us touch him, and had to carry it over to another place to do something. And that poor girl was sweating like a mule. And everybody was aggravated. I mean, folks are just naturally mad in airports. It doesn't matter if it's working right. They go in mad. They don't have to have any bad experience. They just go in mad. You've got the game face on. And so, there were a lot of very, very agitated folk there, and that poor girl trying to fend them off. And so I finally got up there, and I just messed with her a little bit. I mean, she didn't have time to be clowning around, but I said, girl, you working, aren't you? And he said, you bet I'm working. And I said, I tell you what you do. You work on till quitting time, and then take the rest of the day off. She said, she shouldn't have been cussing that, but she said, you bet you're something. I'm going to take the day off, and I'm tomorrow, too. I'm not coming. I said, go for it. Go for it. So we just wolfed around a little bit like that. Now, you picture the scene. Now, I'm talking about a street fight. I'm not talking about Happy Valley. And so we finally got the old bag in there, and I started working through the crowd, and I heard this voice, Mr. Ivester. And I said, what? You done enough with me. She said, come back here. She booted me into first class. I guarantee you, I don't think the governor could have gotten first class. I'd have loved to heard that dude that was sitting back in cattle class saying, how'd I get back here? but you see what I'm talking about? You know, I wasn't looking for anything. I'm just trying to make a little better day. I'm trying to make a little enjoyable transaction with somebody. And, you know, just lend a little hand to something. My God, there's no big deal to that. But when I do it, it's amazing what happens. I wife and I were out in, God, I go all day with that, but wife and I were out on the West Coast. We made that little trip. And we were renting a car. And I'm not wealthy. I mean, I got to live on, but I'm not wealthy. And so I had ordered a Yugo or something. I wanted something that wouldn't drink gas or cost much. And so I ordered the cheapest thing they had. Big time spender. So I went in there, and this little gal was going at it. So we messed around a little bit. And then we finished up. She said, will you do me a favor? I said, yeah, sure. What is it? She said, will you take a... whatever it was the second most expensive thing they had. Will you take that? And I said, my God, people are always asking me to take something. You know, why do you want me to take it? She said, well, yeah, I would just like to see how you like it. Well, it was a luxury kind of thing. I'm a big old thing. You know, I don't lick her hand to take it. But see what I'm talking about? You know, that this is not some kind of, sometimes we say we have to make sacrifice in service. I make sacrifice, but I guarantee you I get back more than I give. Yeah, I'll sacrifice right on, you know. So, and it's just not in just what we do in these rooms. It's when you do this stuff in life, do it in life, and life takes on a different meaning. That's why when I go to bed at night, you know, my menu is gratitude. My God, it's totally unbelievable. I could go on and on with that stuff. I've had flying a lot. I have a lot of experiences on planes. I'll tell you something that's kind of a spirit of this thing too. That for a lot of years, when I would be flying, and most of the time I'm going to an AA something somewhere, and most of the time when you get in the plane. Either people will get into a little glass prison and not react to anybody, just sort of sit there in a coma. Yeah, you get some of that. But you get a lot of people that get bored, they want to talk. Yeah. And that's normally just chit-chat, you know, what's your dog's name and stuff like that. And so for years, I would not lie. I would just evade the question. And by the way, we're going to quit at 11:30. I would just evade the question. Somebody say, where are you going? Said, well, I'm going to Lake Milton, Ohio. What for? And I'd say, conference. What's it about? I'd say, oh, it's about alcoholism. Well, it's not about alcoholism. It's about recovery from alcoholism. So it just sort of fog it, you know, instead of being straight out. And one day it dawned on me, why do I do that? That's got nothing to do with anonymity. My God, that's got to do with fear or pride or something. That's not about the spirit of anonymity. My God, I'm 30,000 feet in the air in a metal tube. Who gonna tell anybody? What's anonymous about that? You know, good chance I won't even get down. Well, I'll get down all right, but anyway. And I thought, I said, shoot, man, that's dumb. And I said, I ain't gonna do that anymore. And I haven't. Not a single time. If somebody asks me where I'm going, I'm going to tell them. And no uncertain terms. I mean, I'm not going to bore them with a whole bunch of stuff, but I'm going to tell them. I tell them about it. And I'll tell you this. I've been doing that now for probably 30 years. And I have never had one single person who was less than keenly interested. I've never had a single one that said ho-hum. I mean, even people drinking. You know, in fact, I found some members that way, too. But it's amazing that, you know, everybody's got one of these things in their tree. You know, there's nobody, it's not a passive subject to people. And every time, it has been enormously rewarding. And I tell you, I found members who hadn't been to a meeting for years who would rekindle a spirit. I found an Al-Anon gal one day on the plane. She's a big old girl from Iowa. So we started talking. And I noticed that she was listening with a little more than the average ear, you know. And she was leaning into me instead of away. And so I started telling her about it. And finally she said, "You know, I used to be in Al-Anon." I said, "What do you mean used to be?" She said, "Well, I don't go anymore." I said, "Why not?" She said, "Well, my husband died. And I know you're not going to believe this part of it." She said, "I just sort of dropped away, and she married another drunk." Can you believe that? Is that historic or what? I got you. She married this guy, and she said, "He's a dimwit." And she said, "He drinks, and he wouldn't let me go to Al-Anon on a bet." And she said, "But I'll tell you what I'm going to do. When I get back to Iowa, I'm going to Al-Anon, and if that sucker gets my way, I'm going to knock him out." And she's big enough to do it, too. But see, there's no harm in that. You know, but what would I do with hiding in that little veil of secret? That's nothing to do with anonymity, for God's sake. And those are opportunities to be of service. Enormous one. One more airplane story. This is a thrill of moment. Let me finish this one and you can do the Benedictine. I was on one going to Fargo, North Dakota, of all places, in February. That is not the way to plan travel. But I was going to Fargo. Got to O'Hare, and they were getting ready to shut down. I got the last seat on the last plane out of O'Hare to Fargo. And so I got on the plane. I was sitting in the middle. It was my favorite thing. Yeah. Sitting in the middle. And there was a little gal beside me. We started talking, and she was a girl that was going to Fargo. She was from Boston. So we started chatting about her adventures as being a librarian and stuff like that, and about what Fargo was like and all that. So I didn't get to the point of telling her about where I was going, because we was talking about her. Just before we took off, I had an open aisle seat, and I was hoping I was going to get over there. But I looked up, and there was there was a kind of a frantic-looking red-haired lady coming down the aisle, and I said, "Uh-oh, I bet she's mine." Sure enough, she gave me a sat down, and we started to talk. And so we started to chat. She had a tough situation. Her husband had just died of brain cancer. She was raised from Fargo. She was going to Fargo for her grief with her family, hers was not a happy journey. And she asked me where I was going. And so I told her, just enough that she caught the drift, and she looked like she'd been hit by electricity. She said, "Are you in recovery?" I said, "You better believe I'm in recovery, girl." I said, "Yeah, I am." And she said, "Me too, 7 years. And well, I mean, you know, we don't mean to be rude, but we often are. And so we started having a sort of semi-closed meeting on the plane. Right before we got to Fargo, I realized that I was really being crude to that girl from Boston. So I turned around and apologized. I said, "Yeah, I'm sorry. I didn't mean to vacate you like that." She said, "No, don't apologize." Always rest of the story, eh? Everybody's got the rest of the story. She said, "Now, what I didn't tell you is that I was to be married last Saturday." And I went down to the church, and we had everything set up, and my husband didn't show. Now, I never have been a jilted wife, but I could imagine how she felt. Yeah. Humiliated. Embarrassed. Unbelievable. And she said, the reason I don't want you to apologize, because when I left going to Fargo, I thought my life was over. It was done. She said, listening to you guys, man, is there ever hope for me? But that's something that, as you get into that little old selfish mode where you're not tuned into other people, you miss those things. And those are priceless, warm memories that come. You know, and they don't, well, anyway.
My name's Mickey. I'm an alcoholic.
Anyway.
You were talking about going someplace to a store or something, and people were asking what was going on. Last night we went to the dollar store across the way here, a bunch of us. And as we were checking out, the girl said, well, they're going to places like emotional sobriety. She said, I have no idea what that is. And I looked at her and I said, it's part of recovery. And she said, what do you mean recovery? Uh-huh. And she says, is it like alcohol where you give up drinking, now you give up your emotions, you know? And I said, no. I said, you learn how to deal with your emotions through different steps. And she says, you know, everybody ought to have one of those.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you very much. By the way, that's not the dollar store. That's the Lake Milton Mall. That's don't tip that out, Bob. Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Yeah. I have a message from Dundee. Yeah, I find that we who come into AA via treatment centers have loyalty to the center. Amen. How best can we learn to turn this around when it's treatment that's relieved our desperation to work the steps? That's a good question. That's a good pondering question. Yeah, that it is. It's a strange thing about loyalty. If you want to test loyalty, think back to where the wheel got put in motion that resulted in your recovery. And just like you were saying, no matter what it is, you will have a loyalty to that second to none. Second to none. And if you've got a treatment center that where you had a good experience, you'll have a loyalty to that. You'll contribute to it. If they have a reunion, you'll go to it. You know, there is a loyalty that goes to that. And sometimes that making that transition is really kind of difficult. It's like I'll give you an example. I started sponsoring a guy a while back. And he had a sponsor. He'd been sober for 13 years, I think. She asked me about it. I said, yeah, we took it on. So we started to talk about conditions and stuff. And he said, do you want to know who my current sponsor is? And I said, well, not really. If you want to tell me, it's okay, but I'm not curious about it. And his sponsor for 13 years was his primary counselor in treatment, who was not an alcoholic. I didn't say anything for a minute, you know, because I didn't want to just explode with some idiotic stuff. So I held myself there a little bit, and I said, let me make one suggestion to you, that you haven't had a sponsor. What you have had has been the longest aftercare program in the world. And that's exactly right. That's exactly right. Yeah, and it's just exactly what Patrick's alluding to, that you know, it wouldn't have surprised you, I know, that this fella, in 13 years, had never had a home group. His home group was that treatment center. He went to meetings, but that's not where his heart was. He had never sponsored anybody in 13 years. He had never had a service commitment in 13 years. So, you know, it's exactly what you're talking about, Patrick. When that loyalty is in there, And it's kind of a tough thing. It's like we're talking about that transition, that important for us. One of the few times I've had a flare up with the treatment center, there was a guy that was going to get me as a sponsor, and somebody at the treatment center advised him not to get me because I was too busy. Well, that's none of a treatment center's business. And that's getting over the line, you know. So we had a bit of a flare up there, but it is a tricky kind of a thing that we want to cooperate. But just like you were saying, we have yielded and we've let the outside agencies take our responsibility, and they didn't take it away from us. We gave it to them, and I think there's some real things that we need to look at in terms of the quality of our relationship, and in terms of what it's doing to the person who's going through the transition. He's got to make that transition. Otherwise, he's not going to may have a good, solid recovery experience. Yeah.
Personally, the reason I put the question to you, Tom, is because I was a lucky guy. I had 2 months in Alcoholics Anonymous before I went into treatment for 56 days, and then I come out and got myself an AA sponsor. I can imagine how loyal that person not doing AA before treatment would be to treatment, and then, as you say, quite rightly, making that transition. It's that 12-step stuff. You know, it's very difficult. How best can we understand that situation when they walk in that door, as you say, rather than that door? Thanks for doing
that. Yeah, it's a real barrier. By the way, we still have work to do with Patrick. Most of us wear shirts that say Dr. Bob or don't drink and don't die. He's got Venice Beach. Have you ever been to Venice Beach?
Los Angeles.
Yeah, sure. I know you're over there looking at those ugly old men on skateboards. I know what you're doing. You got to watch these Dundee boys. Yeah, but that really is. I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's a challenging area. You know, and if you're somebody that wants to take a look at doing a little system analysis, take a look at that. Take a look at it and see what's happening. And I'll give you one other just example of kind of, I'm quick. Were you stretching?
Yeah.
Okay. I'll give you one other quick example of that. That this thing about this relationship between facilities and us. It was over at not the group in that, but another one, but we had a guy came to me one night and he said, Tom, we need to do a group inventory. Now, that's an unusual request. And I said, why? He said, we got too many addicts in here. And I swear to God, now I sometimes I don't see what's right in front of me, you know. And I said, well, let me take a look and see if I see the same thing, because he was troubled because it was a closed meeting. And I took a look. And sure enough, what it was, there was a juvenile facility in the town that was bringing kids over from the facility. And like most of our wounds, it was self-imposed wounds. You know, if we don't get hurt by people, we impose the wounds. And so we met and talked about it, and that's what it was. It was a bunch of kids. Those kids come in, they didn't know if they were alcoholics or nanny goats. They were just troubled kids, you know. So we had a little meeting, and they asked me if I would take the job to go over and talk with the director. Went over there, nice young social worker. They don't teach open and closed meetings in social work school. If we want them to know that, we have to do CPC work and go let them know how we work so that we can cooperate. And instead of doing that, we usually back off and fight. But instead of reaching out, so went in, and wonderful little lady, she said, I never knew there was anything like open and closed meetings. I thought it was just AA meetings. And so I explained that. She said, oh, we'll take care of that. Well, I knew better than that. When you got a house full of juveniles, just like herding cats. I mean, I knew they weren't going to do a lot of sorting, and so they'd try. But we said that's what triggered my strong commitment to the value of newcomer groups that are open, because we what we did in response to that, not only met with her, but we set up a newcomer program that was an open meeting. And that relieved all of the stress and uneasiness of trying to force out or whatever. And what a wonderful resolution. And so, see, it's just a matter of if you're troubled about something, look at it from the standpoint of effectiveness. What is it? Instead of backing off, criticizing, throwing rocks, step in, take a look. Give it your best thought. Put that keen alcoholic mind to work. And it's amazing what you can come out with. You know? And I think that's all in the spirit of what these steps are about. It's not just about just what I've got in front of me. It's about how I can reach out and reach the alcoholic who's not being reached. I'm sorry, I didn't notice you were back there.
Yeah. I'm Renee, I'm an alcoholic addict. Okay. I've been sitting in my seat, and I've been praying about this, and God is making me feel like I need to come up here and say this. I relapsed 5 days ago. I had almost 6 months, which really doesn't matter because really today is all that matters. My recovery, I thought, I held God in one hand and the program in the other, and I lived my life like that, okay? I wasn't at the 11th step, but I still feel I started that 11th step as soon as I walked into the door, at least until I got to that third step when I realized what my came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity. I fell back.
You're right.
I fell back.
Yeah.
I started not missing things somehow, you know. And I guess what I'm asking is when I, as a newcomer, come into this program, how do I watch out for stuff like that? So where, because I'm hard-headed, like all of us are. But how do I watch out so that doesn't happen, you know, to where God made it back this time. Yeah. Next time I might not, you know.
All right, let me address that a little bit. That, number one, shut the door on that 6 months. Shut the door. That's history. It has absolutely no value. That's history. It's done. The worst mistake that somebody can make, I believe, in trying to get back in the program is trying to pick up where they left off. And it's just, it's hard to not do it. So I think it's very important to draw a line and say, that's over. Yeah. You're probably not going to learn a lot of lessons from studying it. It's just done. It's history. It's behind you. And then start out. There was for a lot of years, this may sound a little indirect, but I'll bring it back to you, though. It is that there were a lot of years I really was heartbroken about how many people I saw lose their sobriety and come back and just beat their brains out trying to get it and couldn't get it. You know, one of the old man used to belong to, there was a guy there that fought it for 22 years and then shot himself. It's a tough battle. And I always wondered, why is it that it's so difficult to come back here? And then finally, I found something that the minute I read it, rung a bell. You know, William James, the guy that Bill cited a lot,